Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Hey, there's a new podcast that is living over there. It's the newest release from the 1517 Podcast Network. It's called The Faith and Reason Exchange. It's featuring Adam Francisco, who you might know from The Thinking Fellows, and Dave Anderson, and they're going to be talking about, it's a weekly show, they're going to be talking about the intersection between faith and reason. That's the exchange that they're going to have. How do these things work together? There's an academy that Adam just taught that is now available on faith and reason as well, and so this is sort of complimentary to that. You don't have to take the academy to listen to the podcast or listen to the podcast to take the academy, but you could do both, and that would probably be beneficial for you, so check that out. Chad, we are in Esther chapter 2. We got rid of a queen. You know, the king was not happy with the refusal of his wife, the queen, to come and have all his guy friends gawk at her. She didn't want to do that. Yeah, she didn't like that. So the guys in the kingdom were very concerned that the feminism might spread wild, and all of a sudden the women might start not doing exactly what it is that their husbands told them to do. So they had to make some decrees. They made sure everybody knew that that was not something that should be replicated throughout the kingdom. And they decided, you know what, we gotta have to get a new queen for this king. And so let's round up a bunch of virgins. We'll spend a lot of time, giving them the cosmetics, dolling them up. And then one at a time, we're going to send them on in to the king. And if he likes you, and by sending them into the king, that doesn't mean you go and present yourself and, he takes some notes and then, the next one comes in. This is a night-by-night ordeal. You get the idea. And depending on if he liked you or not, he might call you back. If not, you just go into the harem. And that's just where you are now. You might never see this guy again. Kind of tragic in that way. Like, this isn't, Esther is sort of like this story that you're like, oh, it's a cool story. And it is a cool story, but certainly this part of it it's depressing for Esther too, but it's real depressing for everyone else. Like, there's a lot of young women that this whole situation didn't turn out great for.
Yeah, it's a sad story in so many different ways. This is kind of an aside, but so I went on a walk this morning and I listened to the whole book of Esther. I mean, it's not like I hadn't covered it plenty of times before, but I thought, hey, I'm just gonna open up the Bible app and
Have James Earl Jones read Esther to you?
Yeah, whoever it is. It's not, I wish it were James Earl Jones, but this guy's not too bad. But anyway, I got like halfway through my walk, maybe 30, 40 minutes in, and listened to the entire book. It's pretty short. Mm-hmm. And I like doing that because it gives you the whole story at one time, which is, I think, the way we should cover a lot of biblical books.
Yeah,
but when I got to that part, got to part of the story early on. Of course, it's just in chapter two. I just was shaking my head, thinking, "Man, what a disaster for everybody involved: the families, the girls, just the potential husbands that would have married these young ladies." So, yeah,
I don't think they probably went around like as they were rounding up these women and saying, "Hey, you don't have a boyfriend or someone you're interested in, do you?" Because I'd hate to break up a relationship. I don't think that any of that came into account.
No, they just, whoever was attractive, virgins, they brought them in. And we're talking about, of course, teenagers here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going through all the high schools in Persia and picking out the prettiest and bringing them to the capital.
Yeah.
And so anyway.
And we ended and it's Esther's turn.
It's Esther's turn. Yeah. Yeah. So she's up, verse 15. And that's the way it begins, when the turn came for Esther. And we're told her dad's name here, the daughter of Abihail. And the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai. So, of course, as we learned early on, Mordecai has adopted her, taken care of her, taken her as his own daughter. So it's her turn. And she goes into the king. And she asks for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So I'm assuming that what's going on here is that, so this Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's very impressed with Esther, we've heard that already. He knows the king. That's kind of the assumption I have here. He knows the king. He knows what is going to impress the king. He knows maybe how she should dress or whatever it might be, whatever she takes with her. All we're told is she asked for nothing except what he advised. So whatever that means, I'm assuming that part of that is dress. So whatever the king's eunuch thought was going to, you know, be favorable in the eyes of the king, that's what she took.
Yeah, I kind of read this like maybe this guy's like, all right, what would you, what do you need? What do you want for this night? And she sort of has this, I don't know, you tell me response. Like, I never met this guy.
Yeah, you're the one who needs to be informing me what would be the best way to proceed here. So anyway, whatever it was, she took that. And verse 16 says, when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign. So leading all up to that, so when she goes in this month of Tebet, and four years have passed, by the way, since we've lost Vashti. So quite a bit of time has gone by. So when she goes in, what's the king's response? Well, verse 17 says that the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head, or royal headdress, however you want to translate that, on her head, and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, kind of one more verse, we'll finish out this section. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes. That had to have made everybody happy. Also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity.
Yeah, he's feeling good about this whole thing. He feels like this worked out great. I mean, this part is, it seems like, you know, indisputable that, whatever this means, loved, you know, he loved her more than all the other virgins. I don't know what, you know, so he loved her the most. What I'm not suggesting is that he's in love with her necessarily, whatever. Maybe he is, but what
highly,
it does,
yeah, maybe he is, but highly doubtful.
Yeah. But what, what does seem true is that he's pretty enraptured with her. I mean, he's feeling pretty satisfied. I mean, he's very pleased, and so much so, he's like, I'm going to have a feast, and you know what? Let's get rid of these taxes, and let's give some gifts, and he's really happy with the way this has worked out.
Yeah, so whatever it was, she definitely won the contest with all the other competitors. And even later on, as we'll find out as the story develops, I mean, he, even though at kind of that climactic moment when she goes into the king and he hadn't seen her in like a month or something like that, he's very pleased to see her. So whatever it is, she definitely, won his heart, or anyway, won his approval. So that she's the chosen queen. And yeah, he seems very happy. I mean, he's celebrating this more or less. He's given a great feast and remitting taxes to the provinces, giving gifts of royal generosity. So his heart is moved to generosity. His heart is moved to celebrate. And after this long wait of wanting to have a queen to replace Vashti, he finally has her in Esther. And he really doesn't know anything about her besides, obviously, whatever happened that night. So there'll be more to discover as time goes on, because, you know, as we've pointed out before, he doesn't know anything about her background. He doesn't know
that, that part's so that's like so different, right? It's hard to wrap your head around, like, man, I'm really into this, you know, this girl here, and I'm gonna make her the queen and stuff. Like, you never were like, hey, have your parents come by.
Let's meet the family.
That just never happens.
Yeah, it is. It's so strange to us. I mean, I guess the closest equivalent would be in those cultures today where you still have arranged marriages. But I'm assuming in most of those cases, you still know the person, you know their family. Yeah. I mean, you know something about them. This is just a one night stand, basically, in the Persian world, that turns into marriage, basically. the next day.
Because, yeah, you would think a king would be like, well, let me, you know, obviously you're the queen now. We got to hook your family up and you got to bring them in. And yeah, you just don't get any of that.
You would think that, okay, so he was very happy with they're not together. All right. Well, then, you know, wait a while. Spend a week, 2 weeks, whatever, you know, before you decide, yes, she's definitely going to be the queen. But anyway, he decided right away. So now we have a new queen. And her name is Esther. So we're at that point of the story. What's going to happen next is we're going to find out. We're going to take one of these kind of side trips into another part of the story. And we're going to find out something. Of course, this whole story is woven together as a tapestry. So we're going to find out something about Mordecai, her uncle, or her cousin, rather, that's going to be a prominent part of the story later on.
Yeah, one of the things that you don't know this, so you just have to assume that you have this, we're going to see this like sort of Mordecai like sitting at the king's gate and stuff, but he's not sitting there as like a known, you know, Jewish relative of Esther or whatever. He's trying to like make sure she's all right and that kind of thing. It could be that, you know, maybe Esther just lies to it, like, so, like, where's your family? Oh, I'm an orphan. She's been instructed not to do that. We don't have that in the story, but that would seem like a possible scenario that would have happened, that she would have basically said, I don't have a family, you know, in order to protect the family that she does have.
Yeah, that's true. She might have just kind of kept everything anonymous, you know, just under wraps for now.
Because it was, you know, she's like, hey, bring your mother and father to the castle. She did, oh, I don't have a mother and father, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I have a feeling she's playing her cards pretty close to her chest. She's only letting the king know what he needs to know, just for self-preservation. So verse 19 starts out with a kind of an odd phrase. Most commentators don't know what to make of it, and I don't either. It's translated here in the ESV as, now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. So I honestly don't know what that means. And the commentators that I checked all have different opinions as to exactly what that means. I mean, so when was the first time when they were gathered together? Well, that's never mentioned. So we're not sure what the second time is either. And some people recommend amending the Hebrew text to read something differently just to bring some clarity to it. But we'll just kind of leave that aside. Whatever the situation might be, when this happens, the main point is that Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. Now, there's a couple of different ways that we could take this. It could be that Mordecai is just hanging out there. I mean, we were told that he kind of paced back and forth, you know, was wondering how Esther was doing. He's checking in on her. There's also the possibility that this sitting at the king's gate indicates that Mordecai had been by Esther or even before then some sort of official of the king. Because the gate here, archaeologists have found this gate. There's like, it's huge. It's about 90 yards east of the palace, 13,000 square feet. I mean, this is like a huge, like, complex, more or less, by the palace. And, of course, gates throughout the ancient world is where you had all kinds of business transacted. You know, you had courts that were held there. You had debates that were held there. You had sometimes commerce that took place there. So Mordecai sitting at the gate is probably indicative that he has some sort of official capacity of being there. He's not just kind of loitering, in other words, hanging out there. So anyway, that's where he's at. And we're reminded in verse 20 that Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her. So that jives with what we were saying a few minutes ago. So certainly, she didn't let him know that she was Jewish.
Yeah, what seems unlikely is that Esther went to the king and said, hey, can you hire my Jewish uncle to be like your gatekeeper? That's not what happened.
No, not happening. So she had stayed quiet about that because Mordecai had told her, hey, don't let him know you're your people. And then it adds, because Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. Of course, he's been the father figure these many years. So in verse 21 says, in those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, these two guys, two of the king's eunuchs, whose names are Bigthan and Teresh, they're the ones in charge of guarding the threshold. Now, that's a pretty prominent, that's a pretty important position. These are the guys who are basically guarding the door that would lead in to where the king's at. You know, very, not only a very important position, but also if these guys, for some reason, turn against you, then they have basically immediate access to you. So if there's going to be an assassination, well, these guys would be the perfect ones to carry this out. So there, while Mordecai's sitting there, these two eunuchs who guarded the threshold became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And we're not told why, what kind of what the situation is, but whatever it is, they're upset and they decide they're going to take the king out. This, verse 22, this came to the knowledge of Mordecai. And then he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. And when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So this is some sort of, you know, wooden stake, wooden beam that these guys are hanged on. Now, this seems like just kind of an aside, but it's not, because not only what Mordecai did, but the fact that what he did was recorded in the Chronicles of the king, all that is going to feature later in the story. The important thing to realize now is that Mordecai did something to save the king's life, and he wasn't really rewarded for it.
Right.
It was recorded, yes, but it was not like he was honored in some sort of public way as being this savior of the king. He did it. It was recorded. The king's life was saved. The two eunuchs were executed. And that seems, as the story is told, seems as if that's kind of the end of it, just like it's adding color to the narrative, but it's not. This is going to come back later in the story to be a key way that God is orchestrating events in order to, in the end, bring about the survival and even the thriving of his people as well as Mordecai.
And it seems like, I mean, obviously Mordecai doesn't really get rewarded here, probably due to the fact that he went to Esther with it, and then Esther went to the king with it, and they investigate it, find out to be true. This is further endearing Esther to the king. Like, man, I got this beautiful wife, and then she's like uncovering plots to assassinate me.
Like, save my life, yeah.
The best queen ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and of course, if she wasn't impressive already.
Of course, for Mordecai too. Like, is he like a huge fan of this king? Probably not. But is it better for his niece daughter if this king doesn't get assassinated? Because if he gets assassinated, who knows what happens to her?
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. So he's looking out for the king. He's also looking out for Esther. And all of this, of course, just makes her glow even more in the eyes of the king. She's the best queen that he can imagine, I'm assuming, at this point.
Yeah, he's got this other wife that won't come when he calls. This queen is uncovering plots against him.
Uncovering assassination plots. Okay, so that's the end of chapter two. Now we're about to meet the villain of the story. So here comes Haman. So after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. So I think it was the last episode, or maybe the episode before then, when I mentioned that when he's called an Agagite, that's reminiscent of what happened way back in 1 Samuel 15, where you have Saul sent by Samuel to take out the Amalekites, who were these ancient enemies of the Israelites. And that's where you have the whole situation where he spares the king. And as a result of this, you have Samuel saying to him, the kingship is going to be taken away from him. So the king there is King Agag, and therefore there's probably more than a hint here of kind of this rising antagonism that you're going to see between Mordecai, who's of the family of the tribe of Benjamin, and so connected in that way to Saul, and then Haman, who is from this same lineage that the Amalekites were, these ancient enemies of the Israelites. So at this point, the king has promoted Haman, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. We don't know why. Maybe it's because, it we'll find out in just a minute, he has a lot of money. He's a rich dude. But whatever the reason is, he's promoted him to this high position. And as a result of this, verse 2, all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman because the king had so commanded concerning him. That does strike me as kind of odd. Why does the king have to command all the king's servants at the king's gate to bow down and pay homage to Haman? Is it maybe because if he hadn't commanded it, no one would have done it?
It's a weird thing about his character.
Like,
and it's also,
oh, I wouldn't bow down to that guy unless the king told me to.
It's a weird thing too, like where typically a king doesn't like you bowing down to other people, like maybe it's his son or something, you know, or his wife, you know, or something. But like this guy that's in charge of this stuff, like you might have to like salute, you might have or whatever, show some kind of thing. But there's. And the reason you might just be like, oh, well, this can't be like really like a worshipy thing. But we know, like going on through the text about what's about to happen, that it very much is, which is why Mordecai won't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. That does seem to be the motivation behind Mordecai's refusal, because that's what it goes on to say. So the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. So all you have to do is hear that to realize, oh, we're going to have problems here. Now, the problems don't arise immediately. In fact, it's kind of a one of these has to be reported situations. Haman doesn't even realize this at first, but it's going to lead to the main problem that the Book of Esther is going to solve. So Mordecai won't do it. He won't bow down or pay homage. Presumably then, yeah, like you said, because it's sort of a form of worship of not the emperor in this case, but at least someone who's close to him. So verse 3 says, when the king's servants who were at the king's gate saw this happening, they said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now, one of the things I find strange here is the things we're not told. I mean, we're not told explicitly why he wouldn't bow down or pay homage to him. And we're not told explicitly how he responded to this. Why did he transgress the king's command? I mean, he's going to tell them he's a Jew in just a second, but there's no other explanation that's given. And we're just kind of, it's assumed that we're going to figure this out on our own. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's weird because, yeah, you have this, why do you transgress the king's command? And you have nothing, which makes it seem like Mordecai doesn't say anything. And then they pester him about it. And they spoke to him day after day. He would not listen to them. Then they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them he was a Jew. So the only thing that he told them, so like, why do you transgress the king's command? What's going on here? And then every day they're asking him, like, what's going on with you, man? And it seems like the only answer he gives is, I'm a Jew.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, that's supposed to answer all of your questions. And
I think it doesn't seem
to answer their questions because, I mean, they keep asking, well, okay, you're a Jew. So what? Why you're not bowing down?
I guess the implication is that, like, Jews don't bow down to people, dude. Like, that's not something we do. Bowing down to men is not something that we do.
Especially men like Haman, yeah, the Agagite. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a God, and he doesn't like it when we do that. Mm-hmm. So that's not this is some Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego kind of stuff, man. Like, I ain't doing it.
Yeah, definitely is. Yeah, that's a pretty good parallel to this. So he, like Mordecai, you know, I suppose prompted by the situation, he does reveal that he's a Jew. Of course, Esther has not yet. But Mordecai lets him know, okay, I can't do that. I won't do that because this is who I am. These are who my people are. I'm a Jew. So verse 5 says, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. And we kind of have a nice word play, by the way, in Hebrew here. So Haman, that's Haman, was Hema. That's a word for fury. So Haman was Hema. He was filled with fury.
This is probably because he is so offended that the king's words are not being obeyed.
Oh, I'm sure. It has nothing to do with his ego.
Yeah.
By the way, that's one of the recurring themes of Esther's guy. Talk about somebody full of themselves. Oh, Haman, man. I'm surprised he can even walk. His head is so big and heavy.
Yeah, Haman's not over there like, listen, man, I don't care, but you have
it doesn't
to
matter
do it
to me.
But just the king said you had to do it.
Yeah, this is just, you're really honoring the king by bowing down and paying homage to me. This is not about me. Listen, people, not about me. This is all about honor and glory to the king. No, Haman, I mean, he is, this guy is full of himself big time. And so he's mad. He's infuriated because Mordecai will not bow down to him. So what's he going to do? Well, I mean, it seems to me like the somewhat logical response would be to take out your anger upon the guy who wouldn't bow down to you. I mean, would that make sense? I mean, somebody insults you in the street, then you address it to that particular person. You know, you don't take on his family or his neighborhood or something like that. But no, that's not going to work. Verse 6 says, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him, the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy, to annihilate all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus.
Yeah, that seems like a lot. Like that, so he's like, oh, this guy's a Jew? I'll tell you what, I don't want this sort of thing spreading.
Let's just, well, then we'll kill all of them. This, yeah. I know this is hard to take in. It's like to think of a person who is so infuriated because of what he deems to be an insult to himself. He's like, you know what? I'm not just going to kill this person. I'm not going to kill just his family. I'm going to kill every single person who is part of his people throughout, not just in Susa, but throughout the entire Persian kingdom. We're just going to wipe out the entire Jewish people.
Yeah, that's super weird. Like, you could wrap your head around, I mean, not like in a good way, but, you know, if somebody did something to you, you know, horrible, and you were an egomaniac, you might be like, I'm gonna kill you, and I'm gonna kill your whole family. So I'm Welsh, Chad, and what would be like really crazy if someone was like, I hate you, so I'm gonna kill you and your family. I'm like, well, that seems like a lot, and every Welsh person, and you're like, what? what do they have to do with anything?
Yeah, so this is extreme, in the extreme. I can't imagine anything more extreme than this desire for revenge. But that's Haman. I mean, he is the enemy of the Jews. So how's he going to do this? Well, verse 7 says, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. So some time has gone on. I mean, this is 5 years later. I mean, as we're reading through it, it's like, oh, this happened the next month or something like that. No, so half a decade has passed. In the first month, they cast Pur, and that is the word for lot. That is, they cast lots. And of course, this is all leading to the festival of Purim, or Purim, however you want to say it, which is the festival of lots. So that's where we get the name of the festival. That's going to come up later in the book of Esther as well. So in the first month, they cast Pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman, day after day. And of course, the casting of lots, I mean, we see that in the Old Testament. That's the way they divided up the various tribal allotments of land to the tribes of Israel. And you have casting of lots all over the ancient Near East as a way of deciding what is going to be the, you know, the best action or best gift or best plot of land or what the will of the gods might be. So a lot of casting of lots in the ancient Near East. So here they're casting lots before Haman day after day. And they keep doing it. They cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. I'm not sure exactly how this, they're just waiting for the most positive result from these casting of lots. They keep doing, instead of doing it once, they do it month after month after month. But whatever it might be, they keep doing this until they get to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, and this is his speech. And notice what he does say and what he doesn't say. He says, there's a certain people, scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And here's how we know that Haman was a rich man. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So one of the things he doesn't say is there are Jews.
Right.
Notice that's the way this starts out. There's a certain people, and they're everywhere throughout your kingdom. And the problem with these people, Haman says, is that they have different laws than all the other people. And as a result of this, they don't keep your laws. They have their own laws. They're trying to be their own people. And by doing so, they're actually undermining your authority. They're undermining your laws. They're not keeping your laws. And so it's not to your profit to put up with this. So here's my solution. I'm going to give you a bunch of money, 10,000 talents of silver, which is just an astronomical amount of silver. So I'm going to give all this to you, and let's just take these people out. It'll be to your benefit, to the benefit of the kingdom, that they are annihilated.
Yeah, it seems that he believes that this. If he went to the king and said, "So there's this guy, and he just really won't bow down. I think I want to kill him." Like, apparently, I don't know if he doesn't think that would work, or maybe he's just so full of rage. He's like, "Well, maybe the king would let me get rid of this one guy, but like I'm gonna go way further than that." Obviously he's got there's something about this that almost sounds like the religious leaders talking to Pilate about Jesus. Where you're like, I have to manufacture like why this is a threat, this thing is a threat to you. Right? I mean, yes. This guy's calling himself a king. I mean, what are we gonna do here? This is the same kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a great parallel. I mean, it's a political move, right?
Yes.
You can't go to the king and say, "Hey, I got a personal vendetta against this dude that I don't like," because the king is probably going to be, "Well, why are you bothering me with this? Take care of it." Yeah, so he's got to couch the problem in terms of, it's not my problem. So I, Haman, don't have a problem. I mean, I'm looking out for your interest. I'm looking out for the interest not only of you as a king, but also of your kingdom. Yeah, and that's exactly what the religious establishment did with Jesus. They didn't go ahead and say, "Hey, Pilate, we're really jealous of this rabbi from Galilee.
We don't like his teaching.
We don't like his teaching," because Pilate would have been like, "Why are you wasting my time with this? Get out." No, they've got to present this in such a way that it seems a wise political move on the part of Pilate, or in this case, on the part of King Ahasuerus, to deal with the issue decisively. And of course, I mean, to Pilate's credit, at least he wants to know a little bit more.
Right? He digs a little bit.
He digs a little bit. This whole scenario, and the king goes on to say, you know, yes to this. But this whole scenario strikes me it's telling about Haman, but it's also telling about the king. Really, the king doesn't even ask, who are these people? And how are the laws different from mine? He does no investigation into this. He's basically like, "Oh, yeah, it sounds good to me. So I tell you what, I'm gonna take off my signet ring," which, of course, is the seal of authority. "Take off my signet ring. And I'm going to give it to you," which is what he did. He gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And that's said explicitly in verse 10. And then the king says, "The money is given to you and the people to do with them as seems good to you." So he's all on board. No questions asked. Talk about a dangerous implicit trust in one of your co-leaders of the kingdom. Not even specifying which people it is, and just saying, "Yeah, well, you know, if that's what you want, go ahead and take care of it."
Yeah, I do like this. The enemy of the Jews. So he gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews, like as if we didn't know. They're letting you know, like, hey, just so you know, this is the bad guy.
The Bible does do this sometimes. It's like makes explicit something where you're like, Yeah, we pretty much had one, that one figured out.
They don't want you to
But
miss
putting
it.
everything together, it does seem like Haman is indeed the enemy of the Jews. So we got to get this word out, and that's basically what happens in the next section, 12 to 15. The king's scribes get all the scribes together on the 13th day of the first month, and they have this edict according to all that Haman commanded. It's written to all the leadership, king satraps, the governors of all the provinces, to all the officials of all the people, to every province in his own script, and every people in their own language. They're going to make sure that everybody knows about this. That's the same kind of description we had about Queen Vashti earlier, right? That going to let everybody know what she did. And it was written in the name of the king, sealed with the king's signet ring. So, I mean, he's given Haman full authority here. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to, and it's just heaping up of language here, not enough to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate, just in case, you know, we pull out our thesaurus here. Make sure you get all the verbs. You got to kill, you got to destroy, and you got to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. And a copy of that was, that copy of that decree was issued every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. And then we have this Persian Pony Express that we talked about a couple episodes ago. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. And the king and Haman, having done all this, said, you know what? We should just pour a drink. So the king and Haman, they sat down and they had a beer or whiskey or whatever they were having. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion.
Yeah, I imagine it was. I mean, I'm sure they were like, wait, what were we doing? What?
Yeah. You're kidding, right? I mean, this had to have struck most people as this is like a sick joke, right? No, actually, this was the king's decree. And it's not only happening in the city of Susa, but it's going to happen in all the provinces all over the kingdom.
One of the things, so, I mean, this is one of the things that's interesting here too, like what you bring up, this Agai, there is a, you don't know the motivations of Haman, of course, but this is sort of exactly what Saul was told to do to his people.
Yeah, exactly was what he was told to do to his people, which I think is always going to be in the background of this story. So when you know that story about the need to, what's the language here? Destroy, kill, and annihilate the Amalekites. That's what Saul was supposed to do, right? Everybody, including the king. And Saul, of course, didn't do that. He took out some of them, but he, you know, he saved the cattle. He saved the king. So now we have this descendant of the Amalekites wanting to do the exact same thing to all the Jews, to kill, to annihilate, to destroy. So history is coming back now, where before you had two nations involved, Israel and the Amalekites. Now it begins as two men. You had Mordecai and Haman, but it's going to spread. It's going to spread from there.
That's why Saul should have went all the way.
Yeah, it should have gone all the way. I mean, this part of the story, if nothing else, is a vivid reminder of how the evil of one person, in this case, Haman, can spread like a plague over vast regions of the world. I mean, that's really what's happened here. So from the wounded pride of one man and the hatred that resulted from this, you have this murderous plot that is going to spread throughout an entire kingdom. And then it's going to be, of course, resolved eventually by one person coming in to act in a very sacrificial sort of way in order to stem the tide of this evil. I mean, that's a great example of that common theme that you see scattered throughout the scriptures, which culminates in the gospels themselves, where one man is going to be the one who is sacrificed in order to stem the tide of evil. So in that way, Esther is already preparing us for the gospel that is to come.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but we will find out next episode how Esther feels about this when she gets word, and and how she's going to choose to play this. But you have to wait till next week for that. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then.